Welcome back to another exciting episode of Arbitrary Cases. Today we're going to be talking about the Estoppel Doctrine. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors once more, the Carbolic Smoke Ball. Okay, so, Estoppel. First case is a pre-estoppel case, Hughes v. Metropolitan Railway, 1877. Facts. Through lease, landlord had right to demand repairs on 6 months' notice. Gave that notice in October, and then in November, negotiations began between the leaseholder and the landlord about converting tenancy to ownership. These negotiations fell through, and in April, the landlord exercised his right to forfeit the lease. Ratio. If parties who enter into definite and distinct legal terms involving legal rights, penalties or forfeiture, for example, later, through their own acts or consent, enter into a course of negotiations that leads one to think contract's strict rights will not be enforced or kept in suspense, the other party cannot enforce strict rights where inequitable, given dealings. Central London Property Trust and High Trees, 1947. Facts. High Trees leased flats to Central London Property Trust at £2,500 per year. The war broke out and High Trees were struggling. They only had a third of their flats let out. So High Trees agreed to reduce the price to $1,250 a year. By September 1945, the new receiver noticed the low rent and tried to sue for the back rent. Importantly, by this time, all of the flats were fully let. The court found that where parties have legal intent to accept lower sum in discharge of a larger sum, if acted upon, it's binding, notwithstanding the absence of consideration. Here, the promise to reduce was a necessary expedient given conditions at the time. Therefore, as understood by both parties, the implied contractual term was that the apartments cannot be fully let. Combe and Combe, 1951. Husband and wife divorce. Through letters, they both agree that the husband will pay £100 a year maintenance. He paid nothing. Wife sues after 7 years. And the court found estoppel can only be used as a shield, not a sword. Plaintiff cannot bring as a cause of action based on estoppel. Must demonstrate valid legal contract. He left her to apply to get this done, and she did not. There was no consideration, and there's no injustice here, because the wife made a lot more money than the husband. But the long and short of it is estoppel is only a defense to a counterclaim. John Burroughs Limited and Subsurface Surveys Limited, 1968. So the principals of these two businesses were friends. The plaintiff, Burroughs, sold the company and assets to the defendant for $150,000. The defendant paid cash with remaining balance payable by promissory note, which said on default, one of the clauses of which said, upon default, entire outstanding balance becomes immediately payable. The defendant was frequently late without consequence. Then these two parties fell out. The defendant was 36 days late and the plaintiff said it was triggering its clause, the accelerated payment clause. The court found that there must be something beyond friendship and tolerance, for example, negotiation, to determine that there was an agreement to waive clause and thus trigger promissory estoppel. Negotiation must be of such a nature that it is clear that they both mutually consented to the modification of the contract. They didn't. The main contract had sufficient intent, but the late payments were in the main contract shadow. Therefore, the accelerated payment clause applies. No estoppel. Owen Sound Public Library v. Mile Developments Limited, 1979. Construction contract. Payment due in 5 days from when the library is presented with architect's certificate. If not paid within 7 days, Mile can, with 5 days written notice, terminate the contract. The library asks for corporate seal of subcontractor as with part of the document supporting the architect's certificate. It did not pay because they did not receive. Then Mile exercises option and tries to terminate. The court found that a promise, expressed or inferred from conduct, is intended to be legally binding if it reasonably leads promisee to believe that the legal stipulation will not be insisted upon. Miles, through conduct, made promise not to insist on his strict legal rights. Although payment terms not expressly attached to the consideration, although payment terms were not expressly attached to the conversation regarding the seal, the undertaking implied that it was. The agent's understanding and reliance was reasonable. Also, common business sense. Mile would interpret request for further documents as suspension of certificate's effect. Therefore, Mile was not entitled to cancel. BNC Builders v. Rees. So, wife, you get $300, not full amount. Plaintiff's company near bankruptcy. The wife insisted the plaintiff write in completion of account on the receipt, or else no money. So only $300 and not the $700 odd that they were owed. Plaintiff sues and the wife defendant attempts to raise estoppel. Court found that you cannot use estoppel when power imbalance tips in your favor. There needs to be some kind of detriment. Here, no true accord. No person can insist on settlement procured by intimidation. Even if the receipt was a contract, where there is fraud or unconscionability that creates injustice, then the other party is not bound. There's a bit on the two-part test for unconscionability is, one, substantial inequality in providence in the bargaining. Two, someone taking advantage. NM and ATA, 2003, need legal intent. This is the come live with me, I'll pay your debts, bad relationship, facts. So proprietary estoppel requires assumption or expectation of a legal relationship. Promise was made in the context of relationship, not because Mr. M was trying to compensate her for her detriment. Also, there was a lack of mutuality. Mrs. A could be under no enforceable obligation to stay with Mr. M if he fulfilled the promise. Therefore, she cannot use promissory estoppel. She's also using it as a sword here, not a shield. Collier v. P&MJ Rights Holdings Limited. If debtor offers to pay part owed and creditor voluntarily accepts it, promissory estoppel can be used if 1. Existing legal relationship. 2. Clear promise or representation made by party against whom estoppel is raised, establishing intent to be bound to what he said. 3. Reliance on party raising estoppel on statement or conduct of the party against whom estoppel is raised. 4. Party acted on it to their detriment. 5. The promisee must have acted equitably. That's it for estoppel. Now it's time for privity. It's a subject we know and love. Let's get right into it. So the general rule for privity is you can't sue contracts that you are not a party to. So now, recognition of non-contracting parties. Beswick and Beswick, 1968. Facts. Written agreement. Coal merchant assigns business assets to nephew, defendant. In the event of death, the defendant was to pay his widow £5 per week. He died. The defendant then paid £5 once to the widow, but never again. Widow sues as administratrix. And the court found, under privity, the widow is a third party and cannot sue. But as a state administratrix, she can sue as if she was promisee to enforce agreement. Then, in her role as beneficiary, she can receive the benefit as a third party. The Santanita, 1895, implied contract. Facts, yacht regatta. Both agreed to regatta's rules, competition. Yacht A wrecked the Valkyrie, not following the rules. Ratio, moment you start competing automatically triggers application of the rules of the club, binding everyone, and therefore you can sue, not a third party. Implied contract amongst all yacht owners. Dunlop Pneumatic Tyre Co. Limited and Selfridge & Co. Limited, 1915. This was a failed attempt at the agency exception. So Dunlop and Dew had an agreement. The plaintiff was given plaintiff Dunlop gave discounts to Dew, who could only pass them off discounts off the price list. Dew was only to pass them on if to A, to motor traders, and B, who agree also not to give the discounts to consumers. Dew then entered in a contract with Selfridge and sold at a discount with the same conditions. Selfridge then breached those conditions by selling to a consumer with the discounts. The plaintiff Dunlop tries to sue. So there's three contracts: Dunlop, Dew, Dew Selfridge, Selfridge Captain. Ratio is one. Only a party to the contract can sue. Two. If a person can enforce, then he must give consideration to the promisor. Dunlop. He tried to raise the agency exception. The court said no. Where a principal authorizes an agent to enter into contracts on the principal's behalf with a third party, the result of agents doing so is that the principal has direct contractual relationship with the third party. Dunlop and Dew did not have an undisclosed agency relationship, because there was no consideration to support such an undertaking. Therefore, the Dunlop was not a principal and cannot sue. The Euromedon, 1975. Ajax, the cosigner, was shipper and maker of a drilling machine. Carrier was Euromedon. Clause in the bill of lading between the shipper and the carrier stated that exemptions and immunities to carrier RE, the consigner and the consignee expressly agreed that no servant or agent of the carrier, including independent contractors, shall be under any liability for loss direct or indirectly resulting from any act of neglect while acting in the course of employment. New Zealand was the Ajax stevedore. They received the bill of lading. AM were the consignee. New Zealand passed the bill of lading to AM and then damaged the drill through negligence. The rule. There's four necessary preconditions to trigger the agency exception. One, the bill of lading makes it clear that the stevedore is intended to be protected by liability limitation provisions. Two, the bill makes it clear that the carrier contracts for these provisions on his own behalf and as an agent. Two, the carrier has authority from the stevedores to do that, or later ratification from stevedores might suffice. Four, any difficulty, or this is just an observation, but any difficulty with considerations moving from the stevedores need to be overcome. Court found that there was a full contract formed when the defendant performed services for the cosigner's benefit for consideration that the defendant benefits from the bills, exemptions, and immunities. Through the clause, if part performance was done by another, then sufficient consideration through discharge to make contract, even if the defendant already under a pre-existing obligation to carrier. And the cosignee accepted the bill, was bound to the clause. Mulholland v. Merriam, 1872, the trust exception. Facts. A sealed instrument prepared for John Mulland Sr., deceased, assigning estate and effects to trustee, defendant, on condition that the defendant pay each of his seven children $400 each. Afterwards, like before his death, John Mulholland Sr. granted his son, George, who's the plaintiff, a house valued at $200. The trustee did not pay the full $400 to George and claimed that the house was part of testamentary arrangement, even though it was not mentioned in the instrument. The ratio was that once courts detect a trust, although a beneficiary might not be party to a contract, enforcement component is automatic and is never questioned. So court will never prevent a beneficiary from suing the trustee. An equitable right based on trustship. Jackson and Horizon Holidays, 1975. Jackson pays for a holiday for him, his wife, and his children. Turns out to be terrible, and he sues. So the ratio is, where a contract is made with A for B's benefit, A can sue for B and recover all that B could have recovered if the contract was made with B himself. Mr. Jackson was acting as a trustee for his family. There was a non-monetary intangible value attached to the holiday and held in a sort of quasi-trust. Fraser River Pile and Dredge Limited v. Candive Services Limited, 1999. Contract 1 between Fraser River and the marine insurer had a clause which was waiving subrogation and extending coverage to affiliated companies and charterers. The second contract was between Fraser and Candive, the charterer. And that was just a simple charter hire contract. So Candive takes the boat out and it sinks through an act of their neglect. Insurance pays Fraser, and then Fraser then sues the charterer. This is where we get the open texture principled exception. Insured parties or incidental benefits can invoke this exception where, one, did the parties intend for such a beneficiary to invoke the contract? Two, is a third party performing the very activities contemplated in the contract? Application here, number one, there's no ambiguity. Yes, explicitly, charterers are mentioned in the policy, and Candive were charterers. Two, the contract was to rent a barge and crane to do the work. They were doing exactly that when the boat sank. So this inchoate right crystallized into an actual benefit when negligence occurs. When crystallized, Candive became a party to the initial contract for the limited purposes of relying on the waiver, which therefore cannot be unilaterally revoked once developed into a benefit. London Drugs Limited v. Kuhn and Nagel International is the principled exception. It happened before and is more limited, is pretty much the same, but limited to employees. This was before it got expanded. And it's just one, limitation of liability must either expressly or impliedly extend its benefits to the employees seeking to rely on it. And two, the employees seeking limitation of liability clause benefit must have been acting in the course of employment and performing the very services provided for in the contract when the loss occurred. And that's privity. Now it's time for unsigned documents. First, Lestrange v. Graucub, 1934, the rule in Lestrange. For unsigned documents, it is necessary to prove that the party was aware or ought to have been aware of its terms and conditions. But where a document with contractual terms is signed, absent fraud or misrepresentation, the party signing it is bound, and it is wholly immaterial whether he has read the document or not. Parker v. South Eastern Railway Company, 1877. Facts: the defendant's cloakroom. The plaintiff deposited his bag, paid, and received a ticket. On the one side, it had numbers, the ticket number, a date for the office hours, and a note that said, see back. On the back, there was a clause that said, the company is not responsible for lost or stolen goods for more than £10. The plaintiff returns and his bag had been lost. So the reasoning is, one, for signed written agreements without fraud, it's immaterial that the plaintiff did not read or know of the terms. Two, without a signature, if the recipient did not know or see the writing, he's not bound. Three, if the recipient knew that there was writing and knew or believed that the writing contained conditions, then by receiving and keeping the ticket, he's bound, even if he did not read or know them specifically. Four, if the recipient knew that there was writing but did not think that it had conditions, or he misunderstood the document's nature, for example, he thought it was a receipt or a token or a coupon, and he's only bound if the delivery was done with reasonable notice. Reasonable notice implies that another party communicated to you, even if it's a machine. You look at one, was the notice? Two, was the notice reasonable? So here the railway must take the mankind as it is, must inform. You know, they can settle this in the industry, either by telling at the time or with very clear signs. Lamont and Canadian Transfer Co. Limited, 1909. Plaintiff arrived, gave baggage checks to his father-in-law, who gave them to a customs officer, who gave them to Dunn. Dunn offered to take the checks for free. He said no. Dunn replaced the checks with CTC. Horn came back and asked for a receipt. which Dunn then gave to Horn, who then gave to the plaintiff, who only reads it 10 days later and sees there's a clause saying not liable over £50. And then one trunk was lost and he wanted to sue for more than that. Court said he only wanted a receipt. So he only requested a receipt. So he can fairly, without negligence, assume, without reading it, that it's only a receipt. The defendant must show that a new contract substituted. It did not. Thornton and Shoe Lane Parking Limited, 1971. Plaintiff parked in a multi-story car park thing. There was a notice that said all cars parked at owner's risk. A ticket was automatically dispensed. To see the conditions that governed the contractual relationship, or supposedly did, you'd have to drive around a pillar opposite the machine or go to the office. There you would see a clause that said the defendants are not liable for injury to car, contents, or person. The plaintiff had a personal injury that was their fault and was severely injured. So the rule, for automatic tickets, when you pay, you cannot refuse or get a refund. So an offer is when the machine is ready to accept payment with the terms of the offer right beside it. The notice that said at owner's risk meant car damage. To give sufficient notice, as exempting condition was so wide and destructive of rights, courts would not bind anyone unless printed in red with a hand pointing. So insufficient notice was given for personal injury. That the plaintiff knew that the writing contained conditions is for the defendant to prove. They did not. Acceptance is putting the money in the machine. The customer is only bound, therefore, that if he's given sufficient notice. Further, he's not bound to the ticket terms if they differ, because the ticket was a receipt and comes after the contract formation. Jay Sperling, before we get into the facts of that, has a rule on reasonable notice. It looks like this. Did the offeror do what was reasonably sufficient to give the plaintiff notice? If yes, he is bound. So it's you look at the circumstances. One, was the notice designed to conceal? Two, was the notice hidden? Three, was the offeree reasonable to assume that the document had a purpose other than communicating contractual terms? For example, was it reasonable for him to assume that it was a receipt or a token? Now, J. Sperling v. Bradshaw, 1956, prior dealings. Facts. The defendant had previous dealings with the plaintiff, delivered for storage orange juice barrels. A few days later, the plaintiff sent the defendant a document acknowledging receipt and referring to conditions on the back, which had an exemption of liability clause and gave option for insurance. The barrels, when the plaintiff returned, were empty, and he then subsequently refused to pay because of the negligence. Then they tried to rely on the conditions. So the ratio is if consistency, sufficient frequency, and past awareness, prior dealings could be incorporated into the written terms. Here, extreme notice was not required as the clause was not wild like in Shoe Lane Parking, and it was limited to when the warehousemen were carrying out the contract. Although the landing account and the invoice was issued after the goods were received, the defendant admits that he received many of them before, but merely did not read them. So, on receiving this account, he took no objection and left goods and paid rent for months after. Therefore, conditions were part of the contract. Further rule in Parker 2. Ollie v. Marlborough Court Limited, 1949. Facts. The couple in a motel, they pay in advance for a week's stay, and then when they get to the room, there's a sign. In the room, it's an exemption of liability clause for goods left on the premises. They go out and come back, and the wife's furs are lost. The ratio is reasonable notice must be given at the time and place of the conclusion of the contract. So they couldn't rely on it. McCutcheon and David McBrain Limited, 1964. So that was the goods on the island. They had a 27-page small font document. The space for a signature at the bottom. Type of arrangement it was fast dealings, and there wasn't really time to read it at all. The plaintiff never signed this time, though. Ratio. Previous dealings are only relevant if they prove actual knowledge of terms and assent to them. Prior dealings cannot imply assent to unknown terms, because then there'd be no consensus ad idem. Where circumstances preclude free negotiation of terms, there must be terms that are clear, fair, and reasonable. These were not, but they could not rely. British Crane Hire Corporation Limited and Ipswich Plant Hire, 1975. If parties are of equal bargaining power and in the same business, and in that business there are customs and ordinary practices that everyone is aware of, then those rules would be incorporated. Common understanding can act as a substitute for reasonable notice in these circumstances. That's unsigned documents.